Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Your number one source for Chicago Bulls news and stories. On Twitter at Locked On Bulls, at Jordan C. Malley, and at Bulls _ Pep.
People have their opinion.
What other falsehoods are out there?
A lot of the perception things about us.
Are players buying in, Jim?
Yes.
Fair enough.
Rebuilds are difficult. Sometimes it takes years and years. I still believe, given a really good offseason with this draft pick that we have coming and with our ability to get some veteran players in here alongside these young guys, we can make a substantial leap.
Kick back, relax. Locked On Bulls starts now.
My job is to prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. And these guys are men.
Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Streaming live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. I'm your host, Jordan Malley. Along with me is Matt Peck. Follow us on Twitter at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls _ Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Hit us up on our text and voicemail line, 331-979-1369. We did mailbag yesterday and had a ton of questions and a ton of voicemails. So thank you to everybody who's continued to use that text and voicemail line. Save our number as Locked On Bulls, 331-979-1369. Save that number in your phone as Locked On Bulls. Be able to hit us up whenever you're listening to the show, wherever you're listening to the show. Today's episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. Don't hate like your friend's trip. Book your own with Hotels.com and get rewarded basically everywhere. Hotels.com, be there, do that, get rewarded. Today's episode of Locked On Bulls, we have Cole Zwicker from The Step In, co-founder of The Step In. All of his NBA draft coverage there and unparalleled knowledge about these prospects, especially the guys in the lottery and even some of those back-end lottery players all the way through the second round. We talked to Cole Zwicker about a ton of different prospects, so hopefully you guys are just
welcome
as excited
back
as we
to
were
Locked
to talk
on
to
Bulls.
About hearing
Cole
this
Zwicker,
episode.
He is
the
co-founder and writer
at
The Step In.
Cole, it's great to have you back
coverage
on
at The Step In.
It's been
without further ado,
here is
Cole
Zwicker
on the show. I know a lot of fans for Locked On Bulls were asking for you, and we brought you on. So how you doing, and thanks for joining the show.
Doing well, man. Thanks for having me back. It's an exciting time of year, getting down to crunch time. It's always fun to talk specific team context. I do a lot of generalized podcasts, and it's always fun to focus on a specific vantage point.
Absolutely, and with this time going on, it seems like the Bulls now have worked out, I don't know, probably two dozen, if not more, guys, and hasn't been particularly anybody in the lottery, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to get your first thoughts. So a lot of Bulls fans, and I think the talk around Chicago in general has been about Coby White. A lot of fans are getting a little bit more concerned that the Bulls gave Coby White this draft promise. We know he has a draft promise from somebody, but not really sure who it is. What do you think about Coby White's overall game? And maybe give us a little bit of a breakdown of what you think he's going to be in the NBA.
Yeah, I come down a little bit more skeptical on him. He is basically a scoring guard that got turned into more of a point guard at UNC, but we didn't see enough of his half-court initiation, especially in pick and roll. He did do it, but not at a high level. He's incredibly good at pushing the ball in transition, though. Outstanding transition point guard with his speed. He actually shows some vision in those settings as well. It really starts with him. His game starts with his jump shot, his pull-up game. He didn't have good numbers this year. You'll see 27th percentile on off-the-dribble pull-ups. I think his ceiling and his actual basketball shooting ability is higher than that. But he has that deep range. He can shoot from, 27, 28 feet. Hasn't mastered that forward hop momentum three yet. You see Trae Young kind of sprint into a 30-footer and, hop on balance into it. That's where Coby really has to work as far as his balance on those shots. But he has the best, I think, three-level scoring ability of either him or Garland, just because his shot's a little bit more versatile. You can see him shoot fadeaways in the mid-range. He can get his shot, adjust his release point a little bit over contest. I like him there as far as long-term ceiling trajectory. And you're really drafting him, I think, for his ability to shoot the ball. He's incredibly good shooting off the catch, really catching off the hop and rhythm. So he can play off of other players. That's a very big allure. I'm not sure how he's going to finish. He's not very dynamic as far as explosiveness around the basket. He's got those short arms, so he doesn't have a lot of length extension at the rim. I think those are concerning points. His handle looks high because of his torso. His torso is long. He, again, has those shorter arms, so he struggles to really keep the ball low. He has done it. He has shown the ability to split pick and roll very confidently. He's got to work on as far as continuously getting that ball low in traffic. I think that'll come, but he's more of a developmental point guard. You'll also see him defensively. He'll get a lot of praise because of his size, almost 6'5". I don't think he plays to that size. He has kind of a slender build. I think he's more of a one-position defender than a two-position. So I think that's why he's getting a lot of hype in the draft as well. As you look at Garland, who's 6'3". John Morant, of course, is probably going to go two, but he's also 6'3", very narrow build. I think Kobe is more similar to them, even though he does have an inch and a half of height on them.
Cole, obviously a lot of Bulls fans are kind of keying in on Kobe, right? Kobe White right now, because, you know, VP John Paxson said as much in their season-ending press conference that point guard is a very real need for this roster right now, and it's one that they plan to address. They may also go out and seek a veteran point guard in free agency, but if Kobe White is the third point guard taken, as you were suggesting, John Morant going two, perhaps the Lakers taking Garland at four, for a team like the Bulls, the position they're in, weighing drafting for need versus drafting best available, the Bulls have usually gone best available, but this year we're hearing hints that they may, because that they so desperately want to address the point guard, put a heavier weight in that factor. Do you think, say, that Kobe White is still on the board at seven, but so are some combination of Jared Culver, DeAndre Hunter, Cam Reddish, do you think taking Kobe White because the Bulls need a point guard would be a reach at seven, and should they instead take a wing?
I'm not sure if it's a reach in the sense of what the NBA does is they always narrow down on ranges, so we kind of know where the top eight picks are going to be. So in that sense, it's not a reach, just because I think Kobe White's going to go, maybe he falls to nine somehow, just based on Atlanta's positional need at eight, not aligning with that with Trae Young. So in that sense, I don't think it's a reach, but I'm never a fan of teams just drafting based on positional need. Of course, I think need and best player available, those two things intersect more often than we'd like to think. You have to be able to optimize a prospect, in my opinion, to really get that full value. So I'm a fan of drafting using both of those factors in conjunction with each other, but I don't like just narrowing down and saying, we need a shooting guard and drafting that player, we need a point guard. I don't think that's the best way to go about this.
Cole, looking at Kobe White's game again, from the defensive perspective of his game, what do you think about him as an NBA-level defender, and do you see him projecting as a guy who can fit into a starting rotation maybe 3, 4, or 5 years from now and be a versatile defender? Because the biggest weakness of this Bulls team, and there was a lot of weaknesses this year with all their injuries, but the biggest complaint and the biggest weakness of this Bulls team over the last 2 years rebuilding has been their defense. How do you think he plays alongside guys like Zach LaVine, who like the ball in their hands too on offense and also can be a liability on the defensive side?
I think defensively, he's okay. He's not a bad defensive player. He's actually pretty solid in college. Mixed results as far as getting around screens. Some people like him there more. I haven't seen great tape of him there, but he's capable. And off ball, he doesn't lapse a ton. He's actually decent as far as making rotations. He seems to know what he's doing as far as timing. So I think he's an intelligent player. So that's probably his most promising feat defensively. I don't think he's going to be super versatile as far as switching onto bigger wings or trying to box out bigs. I think he's more of a one-position guy. He's really got to hone his point-of-attack craft as far as navigating screens. He has quick feet, so I think he has some ingredients to be a non-liability, but to me, he's more of a average at best kind of point guard defender at the next level, because most of those guys, like the Patrick Beverleys, those guys are insanely athletic. They have that strength component. I don't see that with Kobe, despite the size. I do like him offensively around the Bulls pieces, though. As far as like surrounding him, he can play off the ball. He can come off screens a little bit, so you can play him off the ball. You can run him off screens with, you know, Wendell Carter in a dribble handoff. If Zach LaVine initiates in a pick and roll, Kobe's going to be a dynamic weak side spacer. So there's a lot of intrigue with him offensively. I'm just not sure if he brings the traditional point guard skill set to the table. He's more to me of like a combo guard, to where he can fit around better players, and that's kind of why he is coveted, I think. But if you want like this go-to guy where he has the ball a lot, he's running 1-5 pick and roll, I don't think that's his game right now.
Cole, the other point guard who is likely to go in that mix of somewhere 3 through 7 is Vanderbilt's Darius Garland, who was certainly impressive in his very short stint in Vanderbilt, only playing, I believe, 5 games before that season-ending injury. What is it about his game to you that makes him a surefire pick? Yeah, it's a weak draft class, but there's, you know, he's still in everybody's consensus top 10 for a reason, despite the very small sample size of games at the college level. And are you concerned at all with just how small that sample size was for a guy who might go top 5?
I'm definitely concerned. It's not just the sample size. It's what we saw in it. The inability to really read the floor, not a natural point guard, grew up as kind of a two guard and then made that transition, not a natural playmaker for others. He can make the simple drop off pass or the pocket pass, but has always struggled to make that skip pass read. And that's something I really value in a point guard, is being able to see the entire floor, manipulate the weak side defender. We haven't seen a ton of that from Garland. But the allure with him is ball handlers always get pushed up in the draft. Teams want individual creation. They want guys who can get their own shot. Garland can shoot from 30 feet. And, you know, his handling ability is top notch as far as how electric he is with the ball. Very live dribble, very deceptive. He really creates separation with these pound dribbles and, you know, hesitation moves, all of those. He has those in his bag. He can split pick and roll. His handle is really, really good. So that's where his allure is that intersection of being able to get to his pull-up quickly. From range, he starts applying pressure, ideally, to defenses right when you cross his half court. You have to get out on him in, like, an early drag screen action, and he can really navigate tighter confines like that. Not a dynamic downhill athlete. He does have burst, but it's not incredible. And he's, again, similar to Kobe White, not very explosive at the basket. So you see a lot of parallels. People watch Damian Lillard in the playoffs, and they're kind of chasing that skill set. Damian Lillard's a world-class athlete. He had like a 33-inch standing vert at the combine. And that's just top-notch for a point guard. You can see that on tape, too. And Garland is not that kind of athlete. If he was, I would be higher on him. But I think you are. He comes at a price of you're not getting, again, those primary initiation playmaking for others' traits. He goes to the Lakers. It doesn't matter as much. You have LeBron. You have Lonzo. He can kind of fill in a role. I actually like him in that kind of role where he can just kind of play the Jamal Murray. I'm going to shoot off screens. I'm going to initiate a little bit in 1-5, but for the most part, I can play off the ball as well. I think that's also the allure with Garland. But most of these kinds of players, they have to play defense. And Garland, I think from a technique standpoint, from an IQ standpoint, was better than I expected. Like, he was much better than Trae Young was at Oklahoma. He's pretty adept at what he needs to do as far as not lapsing. But you're dealing, again, with a 6'3 guy who is a 170, 175, and not an elite athlete without elite length and without elite strength. So I think he tops out maybe as a non-liability, but that's usually not good enough for this kind of archetype. You're looking for more of a Derek White, who is a high-level defensive player and can play make some. Of course, Garland's a much better shooter. So I don't know if he fits cleanly into a winning construct, but there are some teams, especially the Lakers, that could really optimize him, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a sort of a weakness for the Bulls if they decide to draft a point guard, just because we're looking for somebody who can come in and play somewhat of an elite level defense. And it doesn't even have to be elite right away. But I mean, with Zach LaVine there, and we're hoping that he improves over the next couple of years with his defense. But I mean, we're talking about a guy that's already going to be in his sixth season. And how much better is he actually going to get on the defensive side? So we're hoping that if the Bulls do take a young point guard in this draft, or whoever they take outside in free agency, will come in and play somewhat good defense. Switching over, though, just because you brought Damian Lillard up, Cam Reddish, I want to talk about him for a second, because a lot of the knock I've been reading on Cam Reddish is that people don't think he's that interested in basketball, that because of his demeanor at times on the court, just the way that he plays sometimes seems like he just doesn't really care or doesn't put the work level in. And so when he was talking at the NBA Combine, he actually just kind of put that question out of anybody's head. He basically said it was nonsense, that he loves the game and he's passionate. And he actually brought Damian Lillard up. He said, "You look how calm, cool, and composed he is, even at the height of spectacular moments, even like in the playoffs here." What do you think about Cam Reddish's game? And is there any concern at all, some of these things that people are talking about, of his love for the game and maybe just his personality overall?
I can only speak to my own experiences. I was at the week of Hoop Summit practices when he was the most talented player on the USA team. That team ended up losing to RJ Barrett's world team. Usually the USA team wins that. And you can see he did not set the tempo throughout that week. He was kind of nonchalant in practices. Not like a bad kid or anything, but he wasn't that high-intensity guy who was really getting other guys locked in. Like, I've been to past iterations of that team where you had you know, a Josh Jackson, for example, really set the tone in practice. Cam never really did that. So I don't know about his love for the game. I honestly don't know that firsthand. I'm not going to say he doesn't love the game. But as far as having that crazy competitiveness, I have not seen that from him. And I think that is a valid concern as far as his upside goes. He's a weird prospect just because, I mean, he came into the year. A lot of people thought this guy was Tracy McGrady 2.0. I always thought that was ridiculous as far as athletically. It's just McGrady was a top-level athlete, and Cam doesn't have that level of pop. He doesn't have a great first step. He just can't really explode in traffic. It's funny because I actually think his defense is better than his offense. His defense off the ball is fantastic for a freshman, I thought. Maybe not elite level, but like sub-elite. Very good at using his length. He's smart defensively. Like, he knows where to be. He'll have his freshman lapses, but I was really impressed with him on that end. Not really like a dynamic switch guy. He can do it. He has good agility, but again, we're not talking about a top-level athlete. He's more of the Robert Covington-esque guy who, I mean, if that was his outcome, that'd be incredible on defense. He's not quite that good off the ball, but on the ball, he's more that caliber of athlete. Offensively, it comes down to what role do you want him in. A lot of guys still think he's this creator type, and he can play on the ball. He can be, you know, a 1-5 or, in his case, like a 3-5 pick-and-roll threat. I like him more in the role that he was in at Duke. He just didn't make shots. And I think if you look at his game at Duke, you can actually project elements of it instead of just giving him this huge pass based on, okay, he was playing next to Zion and RJ. He didn't have spacing. He didn't have the confidence to play make consistently. It's like he still had these opportunities. He just didn't do anything with them. You know, his handle was loose in traffic. He lost the ball a ton. His decision-making was awful at Duke. I mean, he would just attack closeouts and run right into guys for charges. He had open kickouts available. So I don't think his passing is great. He can pass, but his decision-making has just not gotten to the level that it needs to get at. It comes down to the shooting, and I buy the shot. I know he didn't shoot a great percentage at Duke, but, you know, mechanics-wise, I don't think he's an elite shooter, but I think he can be, you know, a very good shooter, especially off the catch. He can shoot a little bit off motion. We've seen the incredible step backs that he has. He has NBA-caliber moves. I just question if he has the athleticism to functionally pull those moves off against better defensive players. So I like him, honestly, in like an Otto Porter-esque role where he just, you know, is mostly off the ball. He has shot versatility. He can attack a closeout. Maybe at times he can play a little bit in pick and roll, but dribble handoff, stuff like that where you can really leverage his shot. And I don't know what the ceiling is. I don't think the ceiling is what people think. That's why I'm a little lower on him. He's still a top 10 pick for me. I would have no qualms if the Bulls selected him at 7. But I do think you're getting an extreme take whenever you talk about him. It's either the guys who are incredibly high in his creation that have him as like a top 3 guy, or people that are completely out on him because he didn't fill the role at Duke. And that was like an optimal role for a lot of people of what he was going to play at the next level, and he failed at that. But I do still think he can play that kind of role and contribute on a winning team, especially because I think he's the smarter player defensively than he gets credit for.
This portion of our conversation with the Stepins Coles Wicker brought to you by Grip 6 Belt. Today's show brought to you by Grip 6, ultra lightweight with no holes, no flap, and a great Father's Day gift for all fathers out there. Go to grip6.com/locked for your special offer. Cole, as you were just saying, there's kind of like a huge spectrum of people who are really high on Cam Reddish and his star potential, and then those who are very worried about his bust potential and the huge gap that exists there. A couple of the other prospects that are projected to go top 10 and might be on the board, one or either, for the Bulls at 7 are DeAndre Hunter and Jarrett Culver. Of those two guys, I feel like people are kind of not necessarily like pooling them together as far as their talents on the basketball court and what they project to be, but I feel like they're talked about in tandem because most people seem to agree that they both have maybe a higher floor than Cam Reddish, but lower ceilings. Would you agree with that? And say the Bulls had their choice between either of those guys, Culver or Hunter, which one do you think is a better fit for this Bulls roster, and which one do you think has the higher ceiling?
I have Culver as a higher ceiling than both of those other players. I think his playmaking and his ability to create off the dribble just put him at a different level. Hunter is more of a high floor guy. I like Hunter. I think he gets a lot of hate just because the field level isn't great. But he projects very cleanly into an NBA system as far as guarding on the ball and spacing off as far as catch and shoot. But I like Hunter more on the Lakers, where you already have an established construct, and he's really just filling in the gaps behind LeBron, behind Lonzo, Ingram. He's more of a tertiary player. So Culver, to me, has the ability to dribble, pass, shoot, and make great decisions. and that you rarely find that at the top of the draft. I mean, the shooting is a very big wild card. Of course, that's why you see so much fluctuation on his stock. He overhauled his mechanics after his freshman year, where he had a very pronounced left shot line. What I mean by that is kind of a Lonzo Ball-esque shot line. So he brings the ball way over to his left and then snaps it across his face. And he's really improved on that. And you haven't really seen it too much in the shooting numbers because he has really transformed. Like this sophomore year, he was much more on the ball, took a ton of pull-up jumpers. I think he took like 150 pull-ups last year, which is a ton. And I think that influenced his percentages a little bit, just because he wasn't getting those same high percentage off the catch numbers that he was his freshman year, playing off Keenan Evans and then Zaire Smith, of course. So I think he's a better shooter than he gets credit for, even though his form is very unconventional, very high release angle on his shot, meaning like he really brings it up and he elevates it as far as up and not out with his release. So you see him shoot over the top of guys much easier. I'm kind of high on his ability to make difficult shots in the mid-range level at the next level and create for himself because of that release point. But not a high-level athlete, doesn't have a great first step, doesn't have great finishing burst as far as that goes, but he is more explosive than I think he gets credit for. Not as explosive as the picture that was shown at the Lakers workout. He's not a crazy, crazy athlete, but he can finish above the rim. I really like him because of his defense, though. I think that he has really high-level defensive upside, and that's what separates him even from an RJ Barrett type. He really brings it on that end. He's good both on the ball, off the ball. Texas Tech scheme is all about forcing baseline, rotating over, taking charges, challenging at the rim. I think he executed that really well. He's got great feet. He's just really intelligent. I don't care about his measurements at the combine. He weighed in, I think, 195 pounds with a 6'9 wingspan. He plays bigger than that. So that's not a concern point for me. But overall, I think just getting back to the question, I like Culver's upside the most because he's a ball handler. He can play on the ball, but he's also the smartest player of that group as far as Reddish and DeAndre Hunter. And I do think there's something to be said about getting a guy who can initiate your offense for times. And I really do trust Culver for that. He's a better passer, better decision maker than even Garland or Kobe White. So people get attached to this idea of a point guard. We're talking about creating for others and yourself. I think Culver actually does that at a higher level.
Real quick, back on Jarrett Culver and DeAndre Hunter, do you buy any stock into what they did in the NCAA tournaments? Because it seemed like DeAndre Hunter, especially in the championship game, he had his best game of the entire season in terms of points and production, and especially being clutch late in that second half to force overtime. Do you buy any stock into that last game, the championship game, when everything was on the line for both Jarrett Culver and DeAndre Hunter and their teams? Or are you saying, you know what, there may be a little bit there, but I wouldn't be too concerned about their performance throughout that tournament. What do you think in terms of that?
Yeah, I try not to give too much tournament or late season bias. It was a reflection of what I've seen all year from them. So if you were just watching them for a handful of games and you saw that game, I could see putting, you know, an emphasis on it. But really, it just reflected what we've seen. Like Culver struggles a little bit when you put higher level athletes on him one-on-one because he doesn't have great first steps. So creating separation is a problem for him. I think Hunter just shot the ball really well in that game. The defense has been that like that all season, so that's nothing new. But he did pick a great game to shoot really well from the floor. I mean, he played, I thought, pretty poorly in the earlier games of the tournament, even against Purdue. So for me, it's not like a situation where it really vaults your stock. I mean, it's a high leverage situation. It's great to see those guys, at least Hunter, play well. Culver really struggled. But I can't really like give that more gravity than the rest of the sample of both careers, seeing as though they're both multi-year guys as well. So there's a much larger sample at play. It was more just a reflection of that.
That's good to hear. We had a couple of texters ask us a few days ago if they should be buying more stock into guys in their tournament performances and if that has any advantage or disadvantage going into the NBA draft and just translating to the NBA overall. I want to shift to a question and your thoughts on guys that are available in maybe the mid first round or maybe even in the back end of the first round. Because we've been talking a lot about, you know, if the guy that we really want isn't there at seven and being a little bit depressed as a Bulls fan that the Bulls fell from 4 to 7 and being in this position now, what do you think about the idea of the Bulls trading back and trading out of the number 7 pick? Do you think that's a good idea for them in terms of what they could get in terms of value in the mid or late first round? Or do you think that the Bulls are better off just staying at number 7 and taking whoever is available, like a Kobe White, Cam Reddish, DeAndre Hunter, or Jarrett Culver?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I've said all year that if you don't get number 1, I would look to trade back or trade out. And that depends on, of course, the returning value. So I would look more at a future first-round pick rather than, in the Bulls' case especially, trading back. I mean, that's possible as well. But I think most of the value plays in this class play the position that is strongest on the Bulls right now, and that's kind of the 4-5 tweener spot. I think those are, you know, with Lowry, with Wendell. I don't love drafting for need that way, but I think you have to factor it in. Like, if you have that infrastructure and say Brandon Clark falls to 14, trading back and taking him, I'm really high on Brandon Clark. I have him as a top 5 pick. But does that make a ton of sense with the Bulls core? I'm not sure. Same with PJ Washington. Again, more of a 4, ideally can space the floor. I just love his floor level at the NBA level, as far as I think he's going to be a solid player. But does he help the Bulls the same way he would help another team that could actually use a player at that position, like the Minnesota Timberwolves? So that's the vexing part of this class. I've talked to guys in the Pistons podcast, Magic podcast. They've asked the same thing. And those teams are constructed similarly, to where, like, you have Blake Griffin, you have Jonathan Isaac and Aaron Gordon at those 4 spots. And I think that's where the value is of the class. Meaning, again, like Brandon Clark, PJ Washington, even Grant Williams. So I don't expect to go that high. He's more of a a late first round pick. But that's where the class, that's where the strength is, as far as those hybrid bigs who can really pass, make great decisions, and are kind of question marks to shoot, but have good touch. So I project them more confidently than a lot of other people do.
As we work our way towards the latter stages of the draft, from potential trade downs to now touching on the fact that the Bulls actually do have a second round pick this year instead of a basket full of cash. The Bulls making a selection at 38, unless anything changes. I know that a lot of our texters and callers and listeners here on Locked On are saying, maybe don't, you know, feel like you need to take Kobe White at 7. You might be able to get a point guard flyer with that 38th pick. A bunch of people bringing up the name Carson Edwards of Purdue, who I really like, but I think that his stock is rising and I don't think he'll be available at 38. I think he'll probably end up going towards the back end of the first round. Cole, are there any names that you are keeping an eye on who might be sleepers in this somewhat weak draft class who might just slide into those 30s in the start of the second round that might actually be a steal and really good value at that spot?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you start with Tuma Okeke of Auburn, of course, suffered the injury in the tournament. One of the most cerebral players in the class. I'm always looking for basketball intelligence. Are you a good basketball player? This guy is top 5 as far as IQ, great team defender, has the 7-2 or 7-1 wingspan, I think it is, and plays high-level team defense. I think he can shoot the ball off the catch. Again, we're dealing with someone whose ideal position is the 4 spot, but if they're falling to 38, I think you just got to take the best talent on the board. I like him. I think Grant Williams has a chance to fall. I don't think he falls to 38, so I'm not going to really break him down in depth. You mentioned Carson Edwards. There's a chance he falls that far, depending on team needs. I think that's a better value than Kobe White in the top 10, frankly. I'm not in love with Carson Edwards, but he brings a lot of the same traits that Kobe does as far as his, like, what he's bringing to the table. It's dynamic shooter. You know, Carson Edwards, of course, everybody's seen him in the tournament, can pull up from beyond 30 feet, gets great rise on his jump shot, a ton of power in his mechanics, and shoot that game-changing 3. You know, I view him more as a transition point guard. He's not a half-court point guard as far as making high-level decisions and being the hub of an offense. He can play off the ball, though, at a high level. He can run off screens quickly. He can set. So there's a lot of interrelatedness between, I think, Kobe and Carson. Of course, you've been on Kobe's upside because he's younger to develop as more of a point guard type. But if you're just looking at it from the stance of we need this from this position and just the shooting element, I actually like Carson Edwards a lot better as a value play in that area. I think the value, though, at 38 is going to come down to some of these wings are going to get pushed down. I don't know who that's going to be. It could be Matisse Thybulle. It could be Dylan Windler as a shooter. You go down the list, there's Terrence Davis, who's gotten a lot of hype now with the Warriors and the Celtics having a second workout there. Charles Matthews is one of the 5 best perimeter defenders in the class, probably one of the 2 best. Talen Horton Tucker could be there, kid out of Iowa State, one of the youngest players in the draft. He might be more of a second contract guy, but there's a ton of wing value. Daquan Jeffries out of Tulsa, really big body, plays basketball like a football player, 6'5", 7-foot wingspan, can switch a little bit. I'm not as sold on his agility. You know, I think the main guy, though, for me is another one of these injured guys. That's Jontay Porter. And I think a lot of people are probably familiar with that name. I've heard that he's going to go mid-40s, so he should be there at 38. And again, I know there's a lot of overlap with him, Wendell Carter, Lowry Marketing, but as a third big, I think he can be a high-level, even superior to a Kelly Olynyk type of third big. I love him in that area. You, of course, have to feel somewhat confident with his medical, but Jontay Porter, I feel like if he was healthy, for me, he'd be a no-brainer top 20 guy. So him and Okiki, two injury cases. We've seen in the past teams get value in those situations. I think both could be available at 38, and they definitely be my targets.
Very interesting, talking about guys that are in the second round. This question is brought to you by Untuckit. If you're looking for a great Father's Day idea, their shirts are specifically designed to look great untucked and feel comfortable at work or on the weekend. No tucking or tailoring required. Go to untuckit.com, promo code NBA to get 20% off. So, Cole, you brought up Talen Horton Tucker, dude that is from Chicago, went to Simeon High School. The Bulls have also worked out a couple different guys that are from the Chicago area, have played or affiliated with schools that are around this area, Loyola and Clayton Custer. They worked out a couple guys from Northwestern, Vic Law, and also Derek Pardon. But there's been about two dozen guys that the Bulls have brought in for private workouts. And none of these guys are projected to really go in the lottery, other than maybe having a private workout with Jarrett Culver, who they're going to have in a few days. But outside of that, they haven't really worked anybody out privately that's going to project in that lottery. So some of the names that are popping up that might be available in the second round are guys that are going to be undrafted free agents. Guys like LeGerald Vick or Shamori Ponds, Luke May, Zach Norvell Jr. Any of those guys that the Bulls have worked out, and even Talen Horton Tucker, any of those guys do you see as maybe possibly underrated, even if they go undrafted, or anybody in general that's going to go undrafted that you say maybe we keep an eye on and maybe the Bulls should go after and maybe sign to their summer league team?
Yeah, one guy really stands out, and that's Cody Martin of Nevada, someone who everybody is accustomed with. They've seen him play as a four-year player, but he really popped at the combine as far as his athleticism on that level. It's always hard to gauge in the Mountain West, but when he was at the combine, he was the best player on the floor, I thought, as far as intelligence, a guy who can dribble past, make high-level decisions. We don't know about the jump shot, though. That's the thing is, can he shoot NBA threes? He can shoot pull-ups from the mid-range. He kind of plays a little bit like Sean Livingston when Sean Livingston was still quasi-good, which hasn't been for 2 years, but that style of player who can really just pass and make decisions at a high level, can score some. I was really impressed with Cody Martin's defense at the combine. I thought that his strength level looked excellent. He was outstanding, absorbing contact in space, containing perimeter drivers. So he can fit in a system, I think. He can make quick decisions with the ball. He's a smart defensive player, can guard a little bit on the ball, switch. So I don't think he gets drafted just because of his age and the fact that there are so many shooting questions. We'll see if he can make those longer distance threes. I think that's a huge cause of, or at least maybe not a cause for concern. I'm kind of optimistic because of his touch, but something you need to monitor. Like if the Bulls got him in for a workout, I would really try to see how deep his range is. But I think he goes undrafted, and I think honestly he could turn into a top 20 value play in this class just because we see the value of these guys who can handle the ball a little bit. He played college point guard. I think he can run some NBA backup point guard. He's just a really cerebral player, and I'm a big fan of his.
Cole, we've started to see recently this kind of growing trend of, I guess, you know, the phrase that people use is draft promise. As you're talking about teams bringing in guys for individual workouts or, you know, in small groups and having these one-on-one conversations, getting to know the individual behind the basketball player, learning about, you know, their basketball IQ, their character, their personality. And then after bringing these people in, sometimes we hear these reports from reporters saying, it is understood or it is implied that such and such player, such and such prospect has a draft promise from a team. And most often the team is not named. Sometimes the teams are rumored as to which ones have made promises. Sometimes it's, you know, within a certain pick, usually in the lottery. There was one floating around last year where the Bulls made a promise to take Chandler Hutchison at 22, and they did, in fact, end up doing that. I'm just curious, as a guy who does a lot of draft coverage, what your take on this whole concept of draft promises is. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Does it have any impact on teams maybe not exploring all possibilities and kind of being, putting blinders on and focusing on one guy when they should be focusing on several guys?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think you have to be careful about reading too much into promises as well, because some of them might not even be promises. Like when Darius Garland left the combine, everybody thought he had a promise. That might have just been his agent trying to leverage situations and be like, okay, we're going to create this idea that Garland for sure is going in the top six. So you leak maybe it was the Phoenix Suns, you leak maybe it was the Lakers. So it's also a tool to be used as leverage by the agent. I think overall the idea of promises, it's always been kind of interesting. Like, what if you promise Chandler Hutchinson and the player you have 10th on your board falls to that spot? What do you do? You know what I mean? I would assume you still take the best player available. But we've seen that even in the past. I think for the Cavs, for example, I think they promised Larry Hughes in that draft a long time ago, and they passed on Paul Pierce because of that. So I think it can be detrimental to your team if you really go forward and utilize it to the fullest degree and say, we're taking this guy, we're locking in on this guy no matter what. It's just always tough to suss out what are the actual promises actually being made. Or is this just kind of a fabrication, an illusion by the agent or another person in power just to create more demand for their client, which is smart by them. I mean, that's their job, is to work for their client. So I just think you have to be conscious of all those things.
That's interesting. Cole, I'm wondering about a couple other rule changes and maybe some other things that are happening to future classes and how it's going to affect the NBA draft. One is, we just heard that the NCAA is going to move back their three-point line to international level. What kind of effect do you think that's going to have on future NBA draft prospects? And which position do you think is going to be affected most by this?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question. I'm not sure if it'll affect it that much, just because, I mean, they already, teams usually track, and we do on our site, we track NBA threes already. So I think a lot of teams are already doing this. But I'm going to see from a prospect's perspective, as far as aggressiveness, you see a lot of players shoot right at the line, and they're not capable of spacing. So maybe we see more of a delineation there between guys who absolutely can't shoot from beyond the arc. It's more evident just because there's a line out there. So it, people and fans and teams are more cognizant of the approach, because a lot of shooting is the mental side and being aggressive and being confident. So maybe you see players that can't shoot with that range take one or two dribbles in. It's really interesting to see, just because you want to say like the lead ball handlers are be the most evident, just because they're initiating the offense. And college still runs pick and roll, of course. So you can see just how confident guys like that are from pulling up from deeper ranges. So I think probably the guards will be the most evident, at least initially, because the wings are still probably going to take shots from the corner. Very curious to see if teams design plays specifically, again, to run off screens with off-gravity shooters. Like, for example, Cam Johnson can do this in North Carolina. Of course, he's going to be a first-round pick, but he can actually do this in NBA range. He can come off a floppy set, come off a down screen, take an NBA level three. I'm curious to see if other teams will design sets to really optimize those kinds of actions. So it's going to be fascinating. I'm not sure if it's going to have the same effect as a lot of people do, as far as like being completely evident on the floor and teams drawing the same takeaways. Because again, they already track the results and the distance of these, but it'll just be curious to see how it plays out on the floor.
Going off of that, going to international questions. So we heard about RJ Hampton, the number 5 overall prospect, deciding to go play in the NBL over in Australia. And I'm curious, this growing trend of going overseas and getting paid earlier, maybe being able to develop your game at a professional level. How do you feel about this and the way it's going to shift maybe the dynamic in college? And obviously the NBA has had a ton of talk about lifting that one and done rule and maybe even making some of these moves, like moving back the 3-point line to international level as a way to continue to allow kids to come to college and play. And do you think this affects any of their marketing strategy or how they're going to be perceived and overall their brand of guys who are going overseas to play for a year and then entering the NBA draft? The most recent I can think about is Terrence Ferguson. And I just remember his in-depth story, and I can't remember where it was written, maybe the Players Tribune, where he just talked about how difficult the transition was of going overseas and playing with grown men and having to not be an 18-year-old and just be a professional. And he said that was the most difficult thing about going overseas, kind of missing out on all of that. But it seems like it's helped him for the better now. I think he's played well. He played well last season. So what do you think? Is there any concern about guys going overseas and developing their talent there and maybe some drop-off in terms of their draft stock?
I don't think so, because we haven't really seen it. Like, Moutier did the same thing. Moutier was still a top 7 pick. If you have that pedigree like RJ Hampton, I don't think you're going to fall that far in the draft, frankly. I think teams are already comfortable with what they've seen to an extent. It's not going to be a huge detriment on their draft stock. I think it's more the people that are college basketball purists that are upset about this, as far as, you know, you have some tweets about why would he leave all of these teams stranded or something in the decision-making process, or, you know, the integrity of the college basketball game, which is not the concern of these players. I think that's the biggest takeaway, is players don't really care about college basketball anymore. It's a vehicle to get to the pros. So whatever is the best way for them to do that most effectively, if RJ feels like playing, you know, in this international league, if he's going to play against grown men and prove his mental and physical toughness, which is one of his question marks, is how strong is he? How can he battle against strength? If he feels like that's the best vehicle, I don't think it's really going to hurt him, frankly. Like, Terrence Ferguson, like you mentioned, was still a first-round pick. I had my reservations about him as a prospect. I think maybe if he plays college basketball, some of the concerns with his handle his creation ability as far as individually might get heightened a little bit compared to, you know, playing internationally, maybe being a little bit more out of sight, out of mind, where you don't focus too much because he's in a very specific role playing with, you know, more established players. So that might have actually helped him in that case. So I'm not one of those people that says, you know, if you go international, if you don't go the conventional college route, it's really going to kill your stock, especially if you're a high pedigree player. I think that's kind of important, is if you are a guy who's already known from the high school ranks coming out, I think it makes it more palatable for you. If you're not as known, I think going internationally might actually suppress your value a little bit, just because teams don't know who you are and they're not as comfortable with you.
All right, Cole, last one before we let you go. In a pretty strong draft class last year, we saw three big trades go down in the first round. Obviously, the Atlanta-Dallas swap of Trae Young and Luka, which I definitely ate that one. I was sitting here about a year ago on our podcast saying there's no way any teams in the top five are trading down, because Bulls fans kept asking us about trading up from seven. And lo and behold, that huge trade happened. Then you had the Suns and the Sixers swapping Mikal Bridges and Zaire Smith. You had the Clippers and Hornets swapping Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Miles Bridges. Because this is pretty much across the board considered to be a weaker draft class, I'm curious whether or not you have a gut feeling if that's going to lead to less action or more action when it comes to potential draft night trades. Of course, there's, you know, the potential that an Anthony Davis trade or something mega like that goes down. But just as far as teams swapping picks in that first round, do you think because teams are maybe less enthused about this draft class that we might see more action? Or do you think teams are essentially just going to keep their picks and take best available and be done with it?
Yeah, I think that's the $1 million question. You have more teams that are willing to trade their picks, which is not usually what we see, but we also don't know what the demand of those picks are going to be.
Right.
I think having the Knicks and the Lakers in the top five is integral to this. You mentioned Anthony Davis, but just having two destination markets with premier picks probably enhances the chances that a trade gets done in some facet, some capacity. We do kind of have, so this is why teams usually trade up, is if you have an established kind of tier system, and a lot of teams seem to agree, and I've seen from most every mock draft the same eight players at the top of the draft. So Zion Williamson, Ja Morant, RJ Barrett, Darius Garland, Jarrett Culver, Coby White, Cam Reddish, DeAndre Hunter. So those were eight guys, and I think those are going to be the first eight guys off the board. That does matter to NBA teams, because if it's viewed in that kind of tier system, you might have some teams that try to trade up and get one of those last couple players. I'm not sure where that'll be at. You know, the Bulls are obviously a destination team. For that possibly to happen, I would say they probably, if I were to bet on the Bulls, I would say they stay at seven. Phoenix has already said that they'd move their pick for an established point guard. You could see that happen in some capacity. I'm not sure what that would look like. I don't think that, you know, they're not trading number six. I don't think Memphis is doing that for Mike Conley necessarily. It's got to be part of a bigger deal if they trade Mike Conley at all. So it's really fascinating, just because, you know, the Hawks, are they going to keep both 8 and 10? They might package to move up. They might, like it's been reported, they might just trade number 10. So it's really a revolving door right now. Nobody really knows what to expect with this draft. For me, after the top eight, I think that in some order, that's going to be the order. And then it just completely goes off the deep end. And we start, you know, where's Brandon Clark going to go? Could a team trade up for him? Maybe to get ahead of the Timberwolves at 11. So there's a lot of different dynamics to play. I would bet on there being a lot of movement. It just seems to be the consensus growing from a lot of the sources that I trust. These teams are going to maneuver around. Nobody really knows how to assess the prospects, as far as nobody has the same read on a lot of these prospects. You see some teams that have a prospect in the lottery, some might have them outside the top 40. So that, to me, means that a team that values a guy could move up. A team that doesn't value a guy, like Nasir Little, for example, is a late riser. If he is coveted by a team that wants an upside shot, maybe like the Nets or the Pacers, you can see a team move up. It's as you can see by my answer, it's a very unpredictable draft. I think that's the best way to put it.
That's going to be exciting, though. I think that, and same with the NBA lottery, like a lot of people were like, I don't know if this is going to play out the way it did. And then see all the chaos that happened with the lottery. I'm glad that you did say that, because it'll make things interesting on draft night, especially for NBA fans, especially for lottery teams and tanking teams like the Bulls were this year, and even some more at the top. It'll be more interesting for those types of teams than anything else. Cole, final question for you. a year from now, if we were talking to you a year from now, who's going to be one player that we're not talking about hardly at all that a lot of people are like, damn, I can't believe he slid that far. I can't believe we weren't mentioning him enough when we were talking about the combine. Who's that guy for you?
I think it's got to be Brandon Clark. And people were talking about him with the athletic testing. He tested in like the 95th percentile for small forwards, and he's a power forward. So he was even classified wrong. We heard about the measurements, of course, 6'8" wingspan at 6'8". And he doesn't have that reach. He basically has shooting guard measurables. Like, it's the same as Klay Thompson. So I think a lot of people are down on him just from a physical standpoint. As far as, we don't have any comparative points. There's nobody in the league like him. So I think that's why you see him not getting the publicity. You really had to watch college basketball last year to really get it with him as far as just what a high-level basketball player he is. So if he falls to the Celtics, for example, at 14, I think you can look back at it and say, how did this guy get out of the top 8? How did he get out of the top 7 picks based on just pure talent? Because he's so good at basketball. He's the second most functional athlete in the class behind Zion Williamson. He's older. He's 22. He's going to be 23 by the season starts. By the time the season starts. I just bet on him improving. We see a guy like Siakam, who's a late developer, who had that foundational touch. Clark's a better athlete. He's not similar to Siakam that way. Siakam's more fluid, better touch as far as length extension with that 7'3 wingspan. I just think that Brandon Clark is a guy that we're going to look back on and say, you know, this is an elite-level athlete. He can switch. He's an incredible weak side rim protector with outstanding timing. And then offensively, he can do more than we thought. He can dribble a little bit. You know, he's really coordinated attacking the rim, whether that's off closeouts, whether it's off the short roll. He can finish around the basket. You know, he's got incredible non-dunk finishes, a ton of runners in his portfolio. So I just think that people are going to say, oh, we underestimated this guy because we thought that he was Jordan Bell, which is his most popular KenPom comparison, when he's actually much better than that.
A lot of Bulls fans are probably rolling their eyes right now thinking about Jordan Bell, who was the infamous cash considerations trade. But Cole, this has been a fantastic conversation with you, and we appreciate all of your knowledge. And I know all Bulls fans out there are going to heavily appreciate all the knowledge going into less than a month now away from the NBA draft. You can follow Cole on Twitter at Coleswicker. He's a co-founder and writer for The Step, and follow all of his coverage of the NBA draft leading up to draft night on June 20th. At The Step In. Cole, this was fantastic. Thank you again for coming on Locked On Bulls. Have a great rest of the couple of weeks, and hopefully after the NBA draft, you can take some time off.
Yeah, man, it's a fun time. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun to talk Bulls.
Absolutely. Thanks again. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot, Cole.
That's going to about do it here on Locked On Bulls. Once again, I want to thank Coleswicker for jumping on the show with us. You can follow him on Twitter at Coleswicker and all his coverage of the NBA draft leading up to draft night on the 20th at The Step In. He's a co-founder of The Step In. Great coverage of the NBA draft. And if you really like to get analytical with it and you really want to break down each prospect piece by piece, weaknesses, strengths, everything in between, go to The Step In and follow Coleswicker leading up to draft night on the 20th. Subscribe to Locked On Bulls on Himalaya. If you don't have Himalaya's podcasting app, you're doing it wrong. Himalaya's free, super easy to use, and has every single podcast you love or you're searching for. Some of the features about Himalaya that separate them from other podcast providers include personally curated playlists made just for you or by our expert podcast tastemakers. So they will create playlists for you that match exactly what you want to listen to and what's recommended. Themed collections of their shows to help you with podcast discovery. The biggest complaint I've heard about podcasts and why people are either shying away or not really listening or don't really know about podcasts is because they get overwhelmed by the search. They don't know where to start. They don't know where to find the best podcast. So Himalaya helps you out with that. You can find everything from comedy to mystery, thrillers, and sports. You can find all the Locked On Podcast Network shows there, including Locked On Bulls. Some of the other features include listeners can follow their favorite shows and creators. You can also like and comment on specific episodes. You give us a thumbs up if you really like an episode. So if you like this Coleswicker episode, go ahead to the Himalaya app, give us a thumbs up, and drop us a comment on individual episodes. Shareable playlists as well. Listeners can build their own podcast playlist by the episode. Customize it just like a playlist for songs and share it throughout social media, text, and email. So you like a certain amount of episodes that we do and you really, really like those and want to share them with other Bulls fans, go ahead and create your own playlist on Himalaya. Very, very cool. Find us and find the Himalaya app on the Apple Podcast
App Store and Google Play Store. Don't forget to follow Locked On Bulls once you are there. That's Himalaya, and thank you to them for sponsoring our show. You can get our podcast wherever you get podcasts. That's Apple, Spotify, Google Play, anywhere you get your podcasts, we are available there. So make sure you're subscribed to Locked On Bulls so you get our shows as soon as they drop. We're live on Dash Radio, DashRadio.com, and the Dash Radio app on the Nothing But Net channel every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. Hit us up on our text and voicemail line. You got thoughts on anything Coles Wicker talked about, any of these specific prospects? We'd love to hear from you. 331-979-1369 is the place to do that. For Matt Peck, I'm Jordan Malley, and our guest, Coles Wicker. We are out of here, Bulls Nation. Have a wonderful day. We'll be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. For Jordan and Matt, we are out. Deuces.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. Locked On Bulls is live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com